This is WNUT Talk on the WNUT Radio Network. Hello, everybody. It is Brandon here in the WNUT studios for a new episode of WNUT Talk, the show where basically I just kind of open a live mic and we see what happens. I might feel like talking about one-hit wonders, or I might feel like talking about, the time Prince changed his name to a symbol or whatever. Last week was pretty awesome, man. We had three other people in here with me. We had the Great Fish Niz, we had the WNUT intern, and Agito Liv, and we talked about basically just how to ruin your favorite movies and TV shows. So WNUT Talk is a lot of fun to do. It's a lot of fun to listen to. Today, it's just me by myself, and I've kind of got something special for you. You might be listening to WNUT Talk on your favorite podcast platform, you know, like Spotify or Amazon or Apple Podcasts or something like that. But it debuts on the live 24/7 streaming WNUT station, which you can access at any time by downloading the Live 365 app or going to live365.com and just search WNUT on either of those. Man, it is a hand-selected mix of music that I and the Great Fish Niz bring to you, as well as, you know, other personalities from WNUT throughout the years. You know, everything from classic hip-hop to alternative and hard rock and metal, 80s pop. You know, we got a little bit of everything in there. There's just weird-ass songs like Hulk Hogan or Edward Furlong making music that you would never have anticipated would be recorded by another human being somewhere. So a little bit of everything, man. I'm telling you, if you're not listening to WNUT streaming 24/7 on Live 365, you ought to check that out. But if you just want to, you know, on demand your favorite shit from WNUT, you can do that on YouTube on our channel at The Real WNUT. All of these programs go there. They live there. You can go check them out whenever you want. So there's that. What are we doing today? That's a good question. I am here in the studio without a lot of notes. You know, I got nothing really to talk about other than one particular guy. I'm going to set the scene for you, if you will, on a musician that I know and love, and I want you to know and love him too. His name is Jimmy Koo. And in 2004, WNUT did an extended interview with Jimmy for a website that doesn't exist anymore. It lived there in text only. I don't think that the audio recording of the interview was ever released or played anywhere. And so I figured, why not go back through the archives, pull that interview, clean it up a little bit, put it out there for people to get to know this man and get to know the body of work that he has done throughout his career. And this that you're about to hear, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago. This is just kind of the first part of his music career. There's been a couple of decades since then that hopefully we'll get to catch up with Jimmy someday in the near future and maybe talk about some of that. But for right now, let me just take you back and introduce you properly to Jimmy Koo, or James Mahurl, as he was born. And you might read his name in one of the albums I'm going to tell you about soon. And that's how you would see it represented. But we'll get into the Koo change in just a moment. Jimmy has lived everywhere, from New Jersey to Minnesota, California. He's done some time in Texas. And today he calls Dublin, Ireland home. But it was as a boy growing up in Minnesota that music changed Jimmy's life pretty much forever, which you're going to soon hear him talk about. There was an older kid in his neighborhood that would have him over, and they'd listen to Rush, and they would sing along and rock out. And the kid suggested one day that Jimmy should learn to play guitar, which he'd never thought about doing. But he took him up on it. He decided, I'm going to do this. That sounds like fun. I think I can do that. And so he did. And he started writing songs and putting a band together when he was in his senior year of high school, I believe. And that band would be the Coup de Grâce, which Jimmy would change his stage name to reflect, Jimmy Koo of the Coup de Grâce. So the Coup de Grâce started playing shows and converting fans and just rocking houses in Minnesota. They caught the attention of a record label there named Twin Tone, who had bands like Soul Asylum and The Replacements. And so Twin Tone signs the Coup de Grâce to make an album. So they got Soul Asylum's Dave Perner to produce that record, and the self-titled LP came out on November 9th, 1990, in partnership with Red Decibel Records, which was a smaller indie label also based in Minnesota. Twin Tone would do that a lot. They would partner with some of these labels. You can look on their website today and see a laundry list of indie labels they have worked with as one of the larger indies themselves. But anyway, From there, from that debut album in 90, the coup de grace set its sights on world domination. They played shows, man. They rocked everywhere they could. And they basically tried to adjust as times in hard rock changed a bit. You know, grunge kind of came out of nowhere in 91, 92. And as you're going to hear Jimmy explain, things kind of weren't the same after that. And the coup de grace would wind up releasing a second album on December 16th, 1995, called The Art of Survival. But the band's sound would kind of soften a little bit from the thrash-inspired sort of metallic sounds that you hear on their debut in 90 to a more straightforward guitar rock style, you know, a little more radio-friendly, a little more mainstream, a little more timeless, but every bit as heartfelt and inspired by their heroes like Thin Lizzy, Metallica, and even Neil Giraldo, who played with Pat Benatar. You'll hear Jimmy talk about him as well. Now, the 2000s would find Jimmy joining Andrew WK's band. That's right, Party Hard, Andrew WK, the white shirt, the white jeans. Andrew WK has a master's and a PhD in partying, and Jimmy was right there to bring the party across the planet in support of 2002's I Get Wet album and briefly in support of 2003's The Wolf, but he would wind up parting ways with the group in December of that year. A slate of solo recordings as well as collabs with artists like Jimmy DeAnda of the Bullet Boys would follow in the years after that, and in 2009, Jimmy released an album under his own name, Go Down Fighting, credited to Jimmy Koo and Friends, which would feature musicians from the coup de grace and other musicians and close friends that he had worked with in the 20 years or so up to its release. Now, these days, like I said, Jimmy calls Dublin, Ireland home, like his hero before him, Thin Lizzy's Phil Lynott. He plays music in the city, which inspires him to this day, though he tells me, "I don't do the Irish songs," he says. "They hear so much of that over here that they like having an American who's doing all the American rock they love." And so that's what Jimmy sticks to. He even came to know Lynott's mother, Philomena, and looked after her in the later years of her life, providing friendship and helping to commemorate the life of her son, Phil, in a number of ways, and even helped care for her before cancer took her life in 2019. But we are going to go back almost 21 years now. The interview that you're about to hear took place on July 30th, 2004. Jimmy had been out of Andrew WK's band barely 6 months when we sat down to do this interview over the phone one Friday afternoon. Me in the WNET studio and Jimmy in Minneapolis, where he was about to spend a weekend recording some new songs with some of the members of the coup de grace for the first time in 5 years or so. And so that's where we find him on that day more than 20 years ago. Here, for the first time, is the complete WNET interview with Jimmy Koo. This is WNUT, live with Jimmy Koo of the Coup de Grace and also former lead guitarist for Andrew WK. Jimmy, how are you today?
I'm real good. What's going on, Brandon?
Everything's good here, man. So you're in Minneapolis right now.
Yeah, I'm in Minneapolis, and it's the first time I've seen rain in weeks, months.
Where have you been, man?
Well, I live in California, and it's dry.
Okay. Out west.
Nice. Everything's green and plush.
About to lay down some guitar tracks, I understand.
Yeah, it's wrote our best songs ever just before I left the band. We had some inner turmoil in the band in early 2000, I guess it was. And I was like, hey guys, to the guys that mattered in the coup de grace, I said, hey, let's recut some of those tunes, and we're doing it.
Absolutely. How long you been working on it? When do you expect maybe it'll be out?
We're working on it in pieces because I have to fly to Minneapolis to work on it, but I'm trying to have 3 or 4 songs done before August. I'm going to Japan at the end of August to do some Phil Lynott, a Phil Lynott tribute show. So I'm going to have 3 or 4 songs done by then, and I'll probably have 3 or 4 more done a month or two after that.
Amazing. One of the more important questions on my mind as it pertains to your material is there any chance that you'll reissue your older stuff? Because let me tell you, that's some killer shit.
And you know what? I really, really super appreciate that you think that and that, you know, you would even ask that. Heck yeah. I mean, I'm definitely going to, if and when we can get any attention with some new material, I'll piggyback all kinds of that old stuff on there for free. I mean, as you know, I give it away at the Jimmy Koo site, and just want people to hear it.
Right, because, I mean, those two LPs are just stellar.
Well, Guitar Rock is just, I mean, that's been me my entire life. And I was born in the 70s. 84 is when Ride the Lightning came out. And, I mean, that was my record. It was a very important time. And actually, not so long after that came grunge.
Right.
And it really turned everything that I wanted to be upside down and, like, kind of negated all my hard work, it seemed, for a while, for almost like a decade. And it seems like now rock is back as hard as it was when I was about 14. So I'm really excited. It's almost like when you're 14 and you go, oh, man, you know, if I knew all those things, like if I were, you know, and I'm in that position this time. I know what to do and how to do it.
Hell yeah.
And I still feel 14, so that's for sure.
You definitely weren't feeling the grunge movement then?
Yeah, no. To me, that was completely left field. That was them.
Yeah.
It was them against us in a big way. And all the dudes I knew were falling off the boat and cutting their hair. And, you know, I mean, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew I loved Metallica and was never going to cut my hair.
Yeah, dude, they were tough times, especially for the guitar solo that kind of killed it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and fair enough. I mean, I understand how and why and what it went. We've all watched the VH1 shows about, you know, how metal killed itself and all.
Right.
It was just the anti-attitude about playing hard and about trying hard, the slacker mentality of some sort. Oh, you know, that kind of really always rubbed me the wrong way. I really always wanted to go for it, you know.
I hear you. All right, I'm going to set the scene a little bit right now. It's 1990, and Koo's first LP is about to come out on the Red Decibel label. Go into some history for us right now. How long had you been playing before that? How'd you get signed, and how'd your career develop from that point?
Well, there was an older guy that lived down the street from me when I was a kid, and I was living in Minnesota. And he knew I could sing, and he used to have me over and would really high Rush songs, would kind of laugh at me. And then one day he actually said, he said, hey, man, you should learn to play guitar. And I was like, me? It never had dawned on me. He said, you should learn how to play guitar. And this older dude knew about Priest and Maiden and Metallica and Venom and Merciful Fate. This guy was so cool and so pivotal in my existence. His advice, I started playing guitar. He showed me some things. And sure enough, 6 months later, I was writing songs and trying to put a band together. And so that's probably 87.
Mm-hmm.
88. That's all coming together. Coup de Grace got together right away, and I was still in high school. I was a senior in high school, so I was able to spread the word, and we had a big, huge following in Minneapolis right away. It was awesome. It was awesome.
Amazing.
Never before has anything been so easy as that first time up.
Mm-hmm.
Everything made sense, and I completely acted on gut instinct the entire time, and it all worked.
You just kind of shopped the demo around until somebody...
No, I didn't shop nothing. We just went out and played gigs. I took flyers to high schools, and I just told all my friends about it, and we were playing killer metal. We were killing the place.
Mm-hmm.
And metal was big. Anthrax, Exodus, Metallica, Metal Church. I mean, it was on in a big way. SD, Death Angel. Hell, Rigor Mortis was playing gigs, for gosh sakes. And so it was really easy to get the ball rolling in the air. And then Twin Tone, which is like a indie rock label. It was actually, you know, one of the labels that oddly enough helped start grunge, I think, back in the day. But they were the biggest record label in town. They had Soul Asylum and The Replacements, and we were one of the biggest metal bands in town. And so they were like, you know, this seems smart. Let's sign this band. Let's wrap them up, basically. I think the president thought maybe we were going to make some money or we could have done something. So, you know, he figured he'd sign us as soon as possible and then own our careers for the rest of our life.
Right.
Which is kind of how Twin Tone operated sometimes.
Yeah.
And we signed a deal, but they opened up a new record label called Red Decibel. This buddy of mine, Jake Wisely, ran. And Dave Perner, the guy from Soul Asylum, helped make our record with us.
Amazing.
And we love there's a Soul Asylum record called Hang Time. That was awesome. Really, really, really kick butt, slamming record. And Dave was so cool and a great wordsmith, and he really helped me put some songs together on the first record. And the record came out, and very shortly after that, grunge hit, and it was a tough sale, is the short story.
So it was just the timing then.
Yeah, timing, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's a well-known fact that some of your favorite acts of all time are Thin Lizzy and Metallica, but we want to know some of your other musical influences. Who else did you absolutely love listening to and help shape your style?
Pat Benatar and her guitar player, Neil Duraldo.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked Pat Benatar songs. Mm-hmm. And I really liked Merciful Fate guitar player named Hank Sherman.
Right.
Early Merciful Fate, not really the King Diamond, nothing to do with any King Diamond after Merciful Fate. Just all about early Merciful Fate, Melissa and Don't Break the Oath. I mean, that really kind of covers it, because there's offshoots of all of that.
Like, oh, absolutely.
Basically, any of that 80s style rock, was, to me, kind of covers is the Pat Benatar thing, where it's still tough, and there's leads, and there's cool verses.
All right, this is Brandon back in 2025 on WNET Talk. Don't go anywhere, because we're just going to break for a quick commercial announcement, but Jimmy's got a lot more to say about the bands that inspired him, some of the great folks he's met in rock and roll touring over the years, some of the ones that weren't maybe so great, and he's also going to talk about what it was like when he found out that he was basically not going to be in Andrew WK's band anymore. So we're going to go into all that right after this.
Full episodes at 6, noon, and 8. The best music mix all day. WNUT.
Hey, this is the Jazz Man. And did you know who the grooviest cat on the face of the planet is right now? Well, it might just be you, baby, because you're listening to WNUT.
We're back on WNUT Talk. Now, when we last left Jimmy Koo, he was talking about some of the artists and guitarists that inspired him the most in rock and roll, some of the players that kind of made him want to do it. We had talked about the beginnings of the coup de grace and how he got started, you know, playing guitar and putting a band together. We also talked about kind of how the grunge movement made him feel when all that stuff came out of Seattle in the early 90s and sort of knocked down the hard rock and metal he was playing a few pegs right at the time that he, you know, him and his band were really getting rolling. So now we're going to flash forward a few years. The grunge thing has basically come and gone. It's 1995 and the coup de grace second album comes out. How do they approach the changing music world at that time, and sort of where does Jimmy Koo's career go from there? Let's get right back to the interview and find out.
So The Art of Survival is out in 1995. Talk about the events that transpired between that album and what led to your joining Andrew WK.
It took us... Sony paid for us to make The Art of Survival in 90-something. Yeah, we actually were in Pasadena, California, recording the record when O.J. did it. We were watching live on television O.J. running down the road in the white Bronco while we were at the studio. So that helps us put it timestamp on it for sure. We were very excited about it, but we knew that it was almost an impossible sale. We were a metal band, and Pearl Jam was selling millions of records, and it was just there was an anti-vibe. Needless to say, Sony never released the record. They asked us to make it, which was great, but they never released it. And that didn't really bother us all that much, because we're just happy to have the record to listen to. Like, the coup de grace, we're kind of like... sort of like we're really a family group of guys. There's really three of us, me, Steve Resch, and Brett Dagendorfer. And been like decades and decades in the making and in the friendship. So it's awesome.
Absolutely.
So The Art of Survival came out, and again, we couldn't get arrested as a band. So we had some personnel changes. Brett quit for a little while. He was disillusioned. We got an influx of a couple of players, a great bass player and a great lead guitar player. And then Brett came back after a while, and then we went with a three-guitar attack. We added one of our best friends, a guy named Mark Chaussee. Mark was in Fight, and he was in some other notable bands. We think he might be in Manson coming up pretty soon, we hope.
Oh, really?
And we went for a triple guitar attack, and it was the most productive and prolific that we've ever been. We really, really worked hard. We had everybody in town helping us. People were giving us grocery stores, empty grocery stores to rehearse in. And I knew this guy who was loaded and had a bunch of buildings and gave me the keys to an empty building to rehearse in. And like, we just had people pulling for us all over the place. We had some of the best gigs in town. And that was right when we had this blowout. A couple of the new guys that we had brought to be in the band with us that added some of the new flavor brought with them some baggage and some problems that we didn't foresee, namely drug issues. One of them was selling, one of them was using. I won't go into which was which.
Right.
But when one of them ripped one of them off, and so it destroyed the whole thing, and it killed my spirit in a, you know, because all the effort, all the hard work, all the love, all the concern, all the trying, really, really, really have been working at it now for a decade. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And these guys just shat on my dream.
Right.
And really, truly broke my heart. So I went to Chicago on a weekend and just stayed there and just ended up moving to Chicago. And I was living with my buddy, Johnny Kay, and was helping him work on his studio that he turned around and a couple of months later made the first Disturbed record, which sold 8 million records or something.
Wow.
So I saw rock happening around me, and my best friends were right in the middle of making big rock records, and I was right in the middle of the whole thing. It was just a matter of time till something happened for me, because I knew it. I knew this to be a fact. And sure enough, I got a call from a really good buddy of mine named Matt Sweeney, who I'd known for years, and he and I were on Twin Tone together. And Matt was actually one of the guys who had, like, literally discovered Andrew one night at some gig. Andrew was up doing this live karaoke thing that he used to do of himself. He'd play the tunes, and then he'd sing over it. Mm-hmm. And my buddy Matt was at some art opening party or whatever Andrew was doing and saw this kid, and Matt heard the music and was like, oh, my God. And, like, you know, within weeks later, everything was happening. Everything was in place. He had a record label. I think, you know, Andrew had written a letter to Donald. Maddie had called me. I mean, it's like there's absolutely zero question about it. I was the guy for that band. And I couldn't wait. I got to work right on it right away. I started emailing Andrew, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, I'm Jimmy Koo, man. Just, you know, you really don't have too much choice in this, but I think I'm going to be in your band, you know. And so we signed it, of course, right up front. I'd never met the kid, but I signed it right up front. Your friend, Jimmy Koo, you know, because that's the way it's going to be, man. I'm going to be in this band. I can feel it. And Andrew felt it too, so we didn't really have to think too hard about it.
Excellent.
But I did go to New York, and I had an audition with Maddie and Andrew, and we decided it was a good vibe, and then I got to be in the band from then. And then Andrew and I were sort of inseparable from there
good
on
deal.
Out for a while.
Well, what were the circumstances that led to your parting ways with AWK?
I think we just drifted in what our focus was and what we wanted to do. And I think that I may have proved useful to Andrew at a certain point and not as useful now. And, you know, I mean, Andrew's got a business to run, and that's kind of how he operates. You know, is this useful to me? Is this not useful to me? And
right.
If it's not useful anymore, then it's time to move on. So
you guys still in touch? You talk and everything?
No, I haven't talked to Andy. I'm sure that we will at some point.
Right. Okay, now the future. Coup de Grace is looking out into the great beyond. What does it hold for you?
Yeah, well, it's more, I would like to say that it's just the coup de grace because I love these guys that I'm with. And however, I have kind of just taken my own future by its own horns. I have many different irons in the fire.
Okay.
The coup de grace is the backbone of the whole thing, though. That's where it all started from, and that's where it all stems from. But there's the Lizzie Boys in Japan, who I wrote four songs with, four songs in 4 days.
Wow.
And it was one of the most amazing writing experience I've ever had, writing songs with the Lizzie Boys, because they're this Thin Lizzy cover band in Japan. They're the best guitar players I've ever played with in my entire life. Bass player and drummer, also completely awesome. I mean, these guys play Lizzie songs to the T. So this is my dream band. I went over there, wrote songs with these guys. It came with just the right amount of effort. You know what I mean? We had to work at it. We had to work. It didn't come too easy, but we had to work. But the beauty is that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I would love, another one of my plans is to make a record with the Lizzie Boys. Finish this coup de grace record first.
Right.
Started on a Lizzie record. I finally met a drummer in Los Angeles that I like and that I can vibe with. His name's Jimmy Danda from the Bullet Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy was a kid when the Bullet Boys hit back in the day. He was 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's not much older than me right now. I'm 34. I think Jimmy's 35 or 36. He's still in the game. And we got this through another just chance meeting. I had this amazing 21-year-old guitar player kid who, like, you know, talks about old Aerosmith and Allman Brothers and, you know what I mean, like, stuff I'm talking about all the time.
Right.
And plays like it. I cannot believe I met this kid.
Mm-hmm.
Can't believe it. And he's a fucking amazing guitar player. His name's Alex Guitar. and it literally changed his name to guitar. And I'm psyched. I got three real promising projects. And of course, what I do is to any of these things, what I've done with anything in my entire life is walk in the room, find out what the agenda is, and start going for it, motivating, talking about it, mm-hmm. working towards it, guiding others in the same path. Yes. I mean, I'm a band guy at heart.
Yeah.
And when I'm not in a band, I'm, you know, trying to work with one or go hang out with one or something. So I'm right. a band guy, and now I got three in the making.
Hell yeah.
About as happy as I've ever been.
Man.
Yeah.
Who would you say, if you thought about everybody that you've met and toured with throughout your career, who's the kindest soul you've ever met in rock and roll?
No bullshit. Steven Tyler.
Really?
No bullshit.
That is my
Steven
absolute
Tyler.
Favorite
the
band.
Kindest, sweetest, gracious, loving. I know he has many hats, but he was wearing that one when he was with me, and he is about as kind as it gets.
Holy hell, man.
There's one other one, though. I mean, that's in terms of bands, but
right.
there's this other guy named John Sutherland, who's right. a writer. He used to be an old rock writer. He's a world-class long-distance runner. He used to work at Metal Blade. This is the guy that got Jason Newsted the job in Metallica.
Wow.
This guy lost his job once because he told his boss he had an emergency. He had gotten a call from a record label who said, look, Phil Lynott's coming into the airport. We don't have anybody to pick him up. Do you want to do it? John went to his boss and goes, look, man, I gotta do something. Something I have to do. Boss is like, if you leave, your job's gone. John's like, I'm out of here. John Sutherland goes to the airport and picks up Phil Lynott and loses his job. One more John Sutherland story. He was working at Nike in the very, very early days. Nike would make like 300 pairs of shoes, sell them, and then like make 300 more, right? They were mm-hmm. a small company. So John was a world-class runner way back in the day. So he was selling shoes for Nike, like on foot. Like literally, they'd walk to stores. He's walking down Sunset Boulevard one day, and who fucking walks by? John Lennon. They just say hello. They're rapping with him for a second. They give John Lennon a pair of these Nikes. They go back to work. The boss says, Where's this other pair of shoes? They're like going, dude, you're not going to believe it. We gave it to you. Before they could even get it out, the guy's screaming. He's yelling. He goes, I don't care. I don't care if you gave them to a Beatle, for Christ's sake. You can't give these shoes away. They're anybody. And they're like, actually, we did give a pair of them to a Beatle. He's like, you're out of here. Get out of my office. You guys, I can't believe you. 3 months later, the cover of a magazine, a local Los Angeles magazine, it's the picture of John Lennon wearing these Nikes.
Uh-huh.
John goes back to his boss and brings the front page of this thing, leaves it on his desk, and walks away. This guy, John Sutherland, is a special, special dude, and he's an awesome metal dude. He's just been so kind and helpful to me, John Sutherland and Steven Tyler.
Wow.
You should look up some of his old articles. He's written, you know, he was a super well-respected writer back in the heyday and wrote a lot of articles and interviewed a lot of people and, like, Bob Marley, Cat Stevens, Scorpions.
Shit, yes.
He was. Here's the last story about John Sutherland. It's really short.
Ahead,
he was hog-piled by Metallica once.
What?
Like, he came into the dressing room, like, after Jason's first gig or whatever.
Right.
And they were all so happy to have Jason in the band, and everything had worked out. And they all knew that John was the go-to guy that made this thing happen. And the Metallica hog, they were so happy.
Dude,
of course, you know, that partially breaks my heart, because Cliff Burton was the most awesome dude in that whole band.
Without a doubt.
I'm really excited about the new Metallica movie.
Yeah, some kind of monster. Dude, I
haven't had butterflies about Metallica in about 8 years, and I'm starting to get it again.
I have not been able to wait for this movie. And we haven't got it anywhere around here, so I just have to keep fucking waiting, but hey.
Oh, man, I'm taking for granted that I live in Cali because, you know, it's out over there.
Uh-huh.
I really am taking it for granted. I got to go see that as soon as I go home.
We're back on WNUT Talk in 2025, and let me just say, for the record, before I break for commercial, that is a solid movie still to this day. Some Kind of Monster is a solid watch if you like documentaries about really anything, but especially if you're into hard rock and metal, and you want to see Metallica at a point where, man,
Things could have gone really south for them. And in fact, depending on how you view the Saint Anger album, they really did before there was a point of recovery. I'm kind of inspired now to rewatch Some Kind of Monster. I may get the Blu-ray of that, hearing this interview again. So anyway, don't go anywhere. Now, Jimmy just talked about some of the folks in rock and roll that were just the kindest and most gracious and people that he learned a lot from. I'm going to ask him next who wasn't, and his answer made me laugh. I hope it'll make you laugh as well if you know the band and you know the guy. We'll be right back after these words from our sponsors.
Kids playing radio for 30 years, WNUT.
Hey, what do we got here? The ghost with the most. I mean, I can't say my name, you know, it's the B word and everything, but hey, I just want to say you're listening to WNUT. Hey, we really like it down here in the afterlife, you know what I'm saying? Oh my God, them guys are so funny. Anyway, listen, hey, I gotta go, man. I just want to stop by and say, hey, you're listening to WNUT, so keep it up.
You're back on WNUT Talk with me, Brandon, hanging out with Jimmy Koo, actually 21 years ago, but still hanging out with Jimmy Koo, asking him about his career in rock and roll, how he got started, the bands that he's recorded with throughout the years, who some of the folks are that he had the best and maybe not the best times with, crossing paths over the years, touring the planet. He just talked about Steven Tyler, John Sutherland, some of the guys that he enjoyed the most learning at the feet of, so to speak. We're about to find out who one of the people is that he was kind of less excited to meet and interact with, as well as what was it like when he found out that he was leaving Andrew WK's band, maybe not of his own choice. What was that like? How did that come about? Jimmy goes into some of that here. And, you know, it was the first time I had ever really heard him talk about it in the 6 months since it had happened. And this is back at a time when Jimmy and I were in contact pretty regularly. So without further ado, let's go back in time for the conclusion of the WNUT interview with Jimmy Koo.
Who among everybody you've met would you say was probably the least personable?
Well, Phil Anselmo comes to mind right away, bro. Like, what a, I mean, he was always kind to me, kind enough. I mean, right. You know, he doesn't even know that you're actually there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I would see him stand on stage at Ozfest for 2 minutes and not say a word and not let the band play. And just like, of course, he would go out and meet people. I mean, I guess he was personable, but man, that dude's, he's over the top. I mean, no disrespect, man. I'm just telling you flat out.
Yeah.
He's got his own form of communicating that's really primal thing.
Oh,
so
man.
I don't know if I'd say he wasn't personable, but he sure as hell was or wasn't something. I don't know what it was. Next.
All right, buddy. Story time. If you had to pick your fondest memory of the road, what would it be?
Oh, jeez. How about the time I got to dress up in one of the costumes for a Flaming Lips concert? We were in Japan. We were playing Summer Sonic. And I love the Flaming Lips. I loved the Soft Bulletin. And I love the new record, the Oshimi's Robots or whatever it is. And I went over to see them. And oddly enough, apparently they had come on over to see us play too. So when I went over, they had a clue who I was. And I loved them. And so I started hanging out and having some drinks with them and just chatting with them. And then it was getting time for them to go on stage and all this stuff. And they're divvying out the costumes. And I'm like, I'll be the frog. They're like, you want to be the frog? I was like, yeah. I get up and dance. So I was the frog on the Sonic, at the Summer Sonic show for Flaming Lips in 2002. I performed with the Flaming Lips.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, those dudes were so cool to me, man. They were so cool.
All right, if you had to name your scariest experience on tour, what would that be?
Scariest experience on tour. Well, when I found out in Chicago that apparently basically the entire band knew but me that Andrew was thinking about getting rid of me. Everybody knew but me, and it was a complete and utter shock to me.
Wow.
It broke my heart.
Yeah. So that's how you found out.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really did not see that coming. And then 2 months later is when he got rid of me. Because once I found out that he had been talking about getting rid of me,
mm-hmm.
everything looked differently now.
Right.
You know what I mean? Everything that he did, everything that he said, now I realize that he was conspiring behind my back.
Wow.
It was really, really scary and frightening and really showed me who Andrew really is, which is not who we all think he is.
Man, I had no idea.
But that's another interview.
I had no idea that was the way you found out, man.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is that I found out in Chicago, and then I went and talked to him. I mean, I'm crying. I mean, it broke my heart. Like, what are you talking about? What's going on? And, you know, and basically I think that their premise was is that they think that I'm an ass. But Andrew thinks, I think, that I'm probably rude or something. And I'm pretty straight. I'm from New Jersey. I just kind of call it how it is. Mm-hmm. I don't – anybody that knows me would know that that's not the case. But I think he was really – it was just like an older brother syndrome. He just didn't – anything that I did kind of rubbed him the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And, but when I found out that he was going to kick me out and I had no idea – it really frightened me and broke my heart.
Wow.
It was like, you know, it was like chess. It's like he was playing chess the whole time about moves, and I was just like kind of, you know, hop along Cassidy, just right. Getting up on stage and rocking every night, and I realized that there was something going on, you know.
Wow.
That was frightening and really broke my heart.
When you first started playing out there and you were getting a chance to meet some of these musicians you'd looked up to and admired, you know, how did that feel? And did any of them kind of take you under their wing and show you the ropes as like a new kid coming up?
Well, I got to be honest. I think I fit into the whole thing about as good as anybody possibly could. I mean, I had been preparing for that situation my entire life. Mm-hmm. I knew how to be cool. I knew how to be calm. I knew how to be polite. I knew how to shut up. I knew how to party hard. I knew how to not party. I mean, I knew how to hang out with dudes. And when I got an opportunity to start meeting some of these dudes that I love, like Steven, dude, I got a Steven Tyler story for you. I'm going to have to tell you the Steven Tyler story.
Take all the time you need, man. I got it.
I'm going to have to tell you the Steven Tyler story. But I'll tell you what, when I got to meet all these dudes and started meeting Joe Elliott and started, you know, going out and rocking every night,
uh-huh.
I knew in my heart, this is what I was meant to do. And you know what? I was good at it. All the other bands that we toured with, all loved me. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Jimmy was cool. Where's Jimmy?
Hell yeah.
Oh, we kicked him out. What? What'd you do that for? Like, what did he do? You know?
I know, man.
And when all that stuff started happening for me, it felt like a glove that I just hadn't had on in a while. And that is, I can't believe how that type of thing helps me to sleep at night. It helps me to sleep at night to know that I've been able to accomplish some of these goals. Because if they're all remaining unaccomplished or, you know, unseen, then I'm a nervous wreck. But, you know, being able to meet Steven Tyler, you know, so the truth is I can never thank Andrew enough for those kind of opportunities.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But I really appreciate you showing interest, and I'm glad that you make an effort to do things online, and I'm glad to know you and that you're interviewing me. So I'm going to go work on some Coup de Grace rock right now.
Okay, man.
And we'll keep in touch, bro.
Dude, I really appreciate all of this.
Right on, bro.
Thank you for your time, and you lay down some smoking shit in the studio today.
Yeah, right? As soon as I get some mix, I'll send it to you.
Oh, hell yeah, man.
All right, bro.
Thank you. Take care, man.
All right,
man.
Later.
So there you have it, the WNUT interview with Jimmy Koo, recorded July 30th, 2004. So that was done in the months that followed episodes 22 and 23. It looked like WNUT was going to become pretty active again. And, you know, we had the 10th anniversary bash in January of 2004, which we talked about that on our 30th anniversary show, episode 32 of WNUT. But then we just didn't really do anything else. And we kind of quietly went dormant. And the studio sat abandoned for almost 18 years, you know, until the rogues gallery of WNUT personalities and some might call them mascots, I don't know, took over and forced us out of retirement a few years ago in 2022. So anyway, I hope you've enjoyed learning a bit about Jimmy Koo today. I first met him when a dear friend of mine and I, a guy named Brandon Hendricks, who's no longer with us, we went to see Andrew WK play in Charlotte, North Carolina. in April of 2002 on he was just starting the I Get Wet tour. I don't even think the album was officially out, at least not in the States yet. It had come out overseas because we had downloaded it long before it came out in like March or April over here. But anyway, we actually wound up kind of becoming the band's videographers for that tour. And on into 2003, we would follow him from show to show up and down the East Coast, and we would take a shit ton of video that wound up being helpful to them. When the band was putting together a DVD release of some of their stuff several years later, what the fuck was it called? Who Knows? I'm not saying Who Knows the name of it. Who Knows was the name of the DVD. That was kind of a Who's on First situation. But anyway, a friendship with Jimmy Koo would kind of blossom from that experience. And I just admire him as a fellow musician. And I admire him as a great human being who lives life to the fullest. The guy spreads positivity pretty much everywhere he goes all the time. It's kind of his default setting. And we could all stand to be a little bit more like him. I know I certainly could. Jimmy recorded some other content for us back in 2004. There wasn't just this interview, but we did two installments of a thing we called Jimmy Koo Road Stories, which are exactly what they sound like. It was just stories from his tours and his travels around the planet doing music. And so one was about the first time that he ever met Steven Tyler of Aerosmith and how he got Steven's attention in a very unique way. And another was about how he first met Philomena Lynott, Phil Lynott's mother, at Phil's gravesite in Ireland. So I'm going to work on remastering and bringing both of those stories to you in a future installment of WNET Talk. I love them. They're very captivating. He's a great storyteller. I'm also talking to Jimmy about doing a catch-up chat with us here at WNET pretty soon, and maybe even starting up some more road stories. He actually seems kind of interested in going back and reliving some of these things for us and taking us along on some of these journeys. So I certainly hope that we can make that happen. As I said, he is very captivating. He's a great storyteller, and I would love to be able to bring that to you guys. In the meantime, there are three Jimmy Koo albums out there you can track down, though sadly, the streaming age is not preserving his catalog super well. Yet, I'll say YouTube, however, is your friend. You've got the Coup de Grâce self-titled album from 1990. You've got the Coup de Grâce The Art of Survival from 1995. And there is the Jimmy Koo and Friends album, Go Down Fighting, from 2009. There's also a handful of other tracks out there. Like I said, YouTube preserves a lot of this stuff. But I also highly encourage you to track down a CD or an LP. Hell, get a cassette of some of these things. Remember what I said a few weeks ago on WNET Talk about physical media and hunting for great new shit that you haven't heard yet. So I've also added a handful of the man's music to the WNET Live 365 station, so you'll hear it there as well. And lastly, if you find yourself in Dublin, get yourself over to the Merchant's Arch or Bruxelles or some of the other pubs where Jimmy Koo is rocking faces on a regular basis. That actually rhymed. Jimmy and I could make a song out of that. But anyway, ask for some Thin Lizzy, or ask for Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl, or ask for Don McLean's American Pie, and just watch the man cook. You'll be in for a great show. Tell him that Brandon sent you from WNUT. Hey, at least you'll be getting a better show than you might be getting from Phil Anselmo. This has been WNUT Talk. Man, Jimmy really kind of, he was on something about Phil long before the stories broke that had people dragging him a few years ago. So anyway, like I said, listen to WNUT 24 hours a day on the Live 365 app, which is free, or at live365.com. Just search WNUT and we come right up. You can also listen to any one of our programs streaming on demand at our YouTube channel, at The Real WNUT. Just search whatever you want. We got playlists full of great stuff from me, from the Jazz Man, from the Great Fish Niz. We got stuff from the archive. We got new stuff coming out. There's always something happening on Live 365 or at YouTube when you're hanging out with WNET. So we look forward to talking to you next time when the topic is, again, hey, who knows? Like I've said before, sometimes I don't even know until I sit down at this microphone, but we will discover it together on WNET Talk. I will see you next time.